Blog Talk Radio.
Because we want to stay alive. What do we want to stay alive in? We want to stay alive in Torah Chaim, instructions of life, Torah Chesed, instructions of kindness, Torah Rachmim, instructions of mercies. This is now the 190th show of Soul Class in search of ancient, authentic Torah number 46. And we want to just mention to everyone today, blessed is our Creator. We hope to continue our humble efforts to vibe out on Genesis 2:15, quote, "And the Lord took the man and put him into the garden to dress it, slash, work it and to keep it." As well, we, with the Most High's blessings, will continue to review teachings about and by Rambam, Chabad Hasidus plus Breslov Hasidus, including as well teachings reminding the blessed children of Noah, that's all the blessed nations of the world, they have a rich, eternal inheritance and covenant with the Creator, and how that connects to preparing this generation for universal redemption, none excluded. Meanwhile, May the best of our efforts be dedicated like any animal sacrifice, wine slash water libation, or flora offering to be acceptable before the one who in the beginning, quote, created the heaven and the earth. Joining me today, and I think will be the, as far as I can see, our sole co-host today. We've done it before, and I think we'll be ready to do it again. Dennis Ryan, our teacher and our student, our advocate and advocate for the dissemination of the teachings of Rabbi Moshe ben Maimonides Rambam. Good morning, Dennis.
Good morning, Don.
Thank you very much for that salutation. And maybe we'll get Ron Williams, maybe we'll get Cartrell Gore, or maybe not. Or maybe we'll get one of you blessed souls to call in to vibe out with us at 1-347-838-8669. Before we get into the meat of the program, we'd like to throw out some appetizers just to remind everyone that SOUL is an acronym for 7S of SOUL. SOUL, we call it SOUL class, right? SOUL class, S, 7-O, oldest, original, U, universal laws, L, laws, the 7 Noahic commandments, 7th B'nai Noach, and we'd like to think that our efforts are dedicated, hopefully, to the Most High in communing with other human souls, all blessed and with a matter that should be addressed to each one and every one of us continually. We never should forget we all have a divine image. Help us get off and scrimmage with the Tzelem Elohim, which is the divine image, which is no dream. And also we want to try to infuse an understanding that higher wisdoms of the Most High can channel down through the channels that are ultimately known to Him, but have been somewhat made known to us through the inner dimensions of Torah, that the higher wisdom should come down to the lower wisdoms. And you know, but still sometimes a higher wisdom going down to a lower wisdom, which means our human intellect, sometimes can hopefully ignite another person, and hopefully that person ignited can write back a thoughtful response. And I'd like just to share with you something that happened late last week. I had forwarded a song, which was sung in a cappella, just as you just heard now, the Maccabees sing the Book of Good Life. And this was by Yosef Kadurna Shir Malos, which is literally a song of ascent, which is from chapter 121 in Psalms. And in fact, I'm going to read these 8 verses, and I'm going to go into this little piece of writing that was written by Exiled, who was a Facebook friend. So let's just first read from Psalms 121, verse 1. A song for ascents. I shall raise my eyes to the mountains. From where will my help come? My help is from the Lord, the maker of heaven and earth. He will not allow your foot to falter. Your guardian will not slumber. Behold, the guardian of Israel will neither slumber nor sleep. The Lord is your guardian. The Lord is your shadow. He is by your right hand. By day the sun will not smite you, nor the moon at night. The Lord will guard you from all evil. He will guard your soul. The Lord will guard your going out and your coming in from now and to eternity. So I sent that over to Exile, the Facebook friend, and I wrote the following brief statement to him that I said, well, first of all, you know, in Facebook there's an option where you can click like. So Exile clicked that he liked. And by the way, if anyone would like to partnership, fellowship out with Exile, his Facebook ID is capital EX, and there's a space in ILED. And so when he clicked on that he liked this song, this a cappella song, which is simply the singing of the song without any instrument accompaniment, I wrote, I rejoice in your liking this video, Brother Soul. I hope this response reaches you at a good and auspicious time. So I'd like to read you now the response of Exiled, who's a very thoughtful, sensitive man who's also written many poems, and hopefully in future shows we'll be reading more of his delightful poems to inspire everyone, each one according to their level. So he wrote the following response to me. Greetings and blessings, Brother Soul Don. Yes, it is always most fortunate and a favorable time when I hear from a brother soul such as yours. Opportunity travels sparingly these days and times in this realm. So it is best to try to train the mind with eyes wide open in order to see every glimpse of the light, the Lord willing. As I receive your message today, you have indeed caught me in a realm of search, one I've been very familiar with of late, a realm that is dear to me as I move through as a sojourner, knowing that is merely a means to an end. Let us examine our ways and test them, and let us return to the Lord. This blessed video creation truly facilitates a meditation and contemplation that have been lodged first near, then far, first shallow, then deep, in the waters of my existence, as they wash away at these garments, I wear both outward and inward from as long as I can remember. By day the sun will not smite you, nor the moon at night. Yes, I, our illustrious brother Bob, referring to Bob Marley, used this line in his song Night Shift, a song that helped me for years get through the physical toils of working at night and sleeping when possible during the day. This simple song uniting the physical with the spiritual, a sign, a message, another instance of the great love of the Creator for all of His creation, even the perceived most lowly. And so, as your share of this meditation today has helped to steer me, perhaps deeper, perhaps not, I'm called to mind of a variation of Psalm 68, verse 4. Sing unto God, sing praises to His name, extol Him that rideth upon the heavens by His name, which is Jah, he says it, we'd say Yud and then the Hey, and rejoice before Him, meaning the Creator. It is difficult to think of Brother Bob Marley without those words entering the fray. Yet, for me, it is the verse that follows that has carried me since birth, since before that I knew a word was a word. Father of the fatherless and a judge of the widows is God in His holy habitation. For this truth I can truly testify in truth and with impunity from my life, from my experience, and in this burns my greatest love for that infinite light, the Creator of all, aside from whom there is no other. He is truly a father to the fatherless. Born and raised, never knowing my earthly father, and he puts in quotations, a curse, end of quote, I said in youthful ignorance, quote, a dreaded curse, and end of quote, an unknowing lack of discipline, lack of obedience, no guide to lead the way, ego growing beyond recognition, rebelling for the sake of rebellion, a lack of that patriarchal love that mankind does truly need. But how the great Creator does work, every dark and dread end road that I turned down had a glimmer of light, just enough to keep me from falling over the edges of my own accord. Every detour taken from the straight road, another way out, ah yes. Two streets over, one street down. The point, of course, is that the Most High was and is there. The point, of course, that since I was lacking an earthly father, how much more did the Lord compensate me, this lowly of lowly creatures, with His own discipline, mercy, loving kindness, authority? How much more did He protect me and now calls as only a father can call? But You, God, see the trouble of the afflicted. You consider their grief and take it in hand. The victims commit themselves to You. You are the helper of the fatherless. For in You, the fatherless find compassion. So I come to put You on trial. I will be quick to testify against those who oppress the fatherless. Ears and eyes wide open. Oh yes, Brother Don, see what randomly of blending meditative waves you have brought forth from this small part of the ocean of one heart on this glorious day of the Most High. My help is from the Lord, the Maker of earth. Give thanks, Brother, for Your existence. As been said, no crossing this path by mere coincidence. Let us return to the Lord, Salah, which is an expression Hebrew meaning for eternity. Ahav Echad, one love. So I look at this, Dennis, and anyone out there listening right now, as here is a person not afraid, not just to write down what he got out of that mere humble exchange of energy transformed from just clicking a couple buttons that he could hear a song, but to actually cause him to reflect upon his own life, and hopefully his reflections of his own life shall cause us, whether we've been raised with a father or not with a father. I mean, I thank God was raised with a father, who's still alive. May Hashem the Most High bless him for many good and plentiful and healthy years, spiritually and physically. That's why we're trying to make these humble efforts, blessed souls, to reach out and vibe out and then share it with another person and see how they spark off it. And to actually let that be the beginning of the show so hundreds and hundreds of people can think about the testimony of one young man. Although he might not young compared to, like, say, a 20-year-old, but he is a young man compared to a 120-year-old, how one song just forwarded him, just the click of a button, reminded him of another song and the reflections of his life and the need to change for the better. Dennis, what's your take on all these meanderings that I just offered before yourself and others?
Well, it is meanderings, Don, because you're covering a lot of ground, a lot of principles, a lot of concepts. But the one thing that permeates the whole presentation you created here is that in the mind, it can happen in 1 second where you can change everything and see the light and identify with God as opposed to questioning Him. It's very nice from a human viewpoint for us to question things, but we don't, or we shouldn't, be directing our questions at God, like, why have you forsaken me? Because I don't have a father. That's like transferring the blame to God, saying that your misgivings were created by someone else, when in effect, it's called life, and each human must live their life, and they must remember they have the power in their mind to recreate their life by identifying with God.
True. Thank you, Dennis. Now, we'd like to switch to a contemporary issue, which we began to talk about last week, and again, we offer our prayers that this situation get alleviated, because it's a human need that there should be a bounty of food upon the creation, because, quite frankly, blessed souls, if there's not enough food in the world and people are starving, it affects our cognitive sensitivities. It can affect our spiritual efforts. Yes, people starve and they reach out to God, but we want those who are starving to be fed through the agency of human beings being blessed by the Most High through the fields and the orchards and the forests, which provide so much produce. But I'd like to share with you an article. I just arbitrarily picked something off the net this morning before the show, and this was published in The Telegraph. And this was written yesterday by a Philip Sherwell, who is called the U.S. editor of this paper called The Telegraph, which, I'll be honest with you, I never heard of it before. And the title of this article, and of course we'll ask Dennis or to chime in on this after I finish the article, and then, of course, anyone, again, who wants to call in can make their comments, questions, or concerns at 1-347-838-8669. So the article goes like this. Worst drought, in decades in the American heartlands threatens to put farmers out of business. And again, this is by Philip Sherwell. This was published yesterday on the net. The worst drought in decades in the American heartlands threatens to put farmers out of business and force up food prices around the world. And the story goes like this. The fields on Eddie Melton's farm in the rolling terrain of western Kentucky should be covered by a thick green quilt of 8 feet high corn stalks at this time of year. Instead, withered brown plants, barely half that height, are straggling out of the barren soil. The sorry landscape, repeated in states across the American heartlands, is testimony to the worst drought to strike the region for more than half a century. Mr. Melton chimed in, this drought has already devastated the corn crop, who farms 1,500 acres settled by his great-great-grandfather in the late 19th century. Quote, we're just praying for some rain to save the soybeans. Excuse me. The U.S. Agricultural Department last week designated 1,297 counties across 29 of the 48 mainline states as, quote, primary natural disaster areas, end of quote. The debilitating combination of low rainfall and high temperatures has produced America's largest drought zone since 1956, with more than half the country officially classed as suffering drought conditions. And as for many farmers, it evoked stories from their fathers and grandfathers of the Dust Bowl era of the 1930s. In a telling illustration of the drought's impact, a golf tournament in Indiana was halted last week after a player lost the ball down the deep fissures in the bone-dry earth of what was once a water hazard. Corn and soybean farmers in America's Midwest are reeling, and on the plains, ranchers are selling off their cattle early and cheaply as they struggle to feed their livestock on scorched prairie pastures after already using up next winter's stores of hay. Consumers around the globe will encounter higher food prices as a result of the drought ravaging the world's biggest grain exporter. Economists are warning that already volatile wheat importing regions of Africa and the Middle East will face potentially destabilizing increases in prices. And domestically, the drought is delivering a fresh economic challenge for President Barack Obama, whose re-election and hopes in November have been left in the balance by the country's stuttering recovery from recession. Indeed, it is not just Mr. Melton and his friends who have been hoping for divine intervention. Quote, I get on my knees every day, and I'm saying an extra prayer right now, said Tim Vilsack, the agricultural secretary, after a briefing Mr. Obama, President Obama, on the crisis at the White House. Quote, Mr. Vilsack said, if I had a rain prayer or a rain dance, I could do it, I would do it, end of quote. The latest bald statistics from his department paint a grim picture. In the 18 corn-growing states hit by the drought, just 31% of the crop is in, quote-unquote, good condition, and 38% is listed as, quote-unquote, poor slash very poor. The figures for Kentucky are even worse, 6 and 77% respectively. Soybean, for which the growing season is slightly later, is faring marginally better at this stage. But with the long-range forecast offering little sign of relief from the skies, that crop could also suffer just as badly by harvest time. Indiana is another state taking a beating. At the Huntington County Fair in the north of the state this weekend, the talk between the antique tractor, parade, pie-baking contest, and archery demonstrations turned inevitably to the weather. A stable subject for farmers at the best of times, but a topic now of financial survival. Said Paul Jacobs, who runs the Drifty Land Farm with his father, we have just had our 23rd successive day of temperatures above 90 degrees Fahrenheit. The previous record for consecutive days above 90 degrees Fahrenheit was 14. We ran into some spring planting in very dry soil after a mild winter, so there was very little moisture in the subsoil at that state. Excuse me. And now we're just desperate for some real rain. Corn rises jumped up again on Wednesday due to deteriorating conditions, rising as nearly $8 a bushel to extend a rally in which the grains prices jumped up 50% over the past few months. Mr. Jacobs has crop insurance, which covers some farmers for a proportion of their losses. As Mr. Jacobs added, it's going to take some farmers several years to recover from this financially, even if they do survive. Others are not going to make it. It has not gone unnoticed in drought-plagued middle America that Britain has been suffering from the opposite extremes of precipitation in the run-up to the Olympics. As Mr. Melton said, just send us over some rain during the game, said Mr. Melton. We'll take anything right now. The impact of the drought has spread beyond farming as a spate of prairie and forest fires have been blamed on the mixture of extreme heat and dryness. In Missouri, there was a report of hay in a barn combusting on its own. Falling water levels are also taking a toll on the Mississippi and Ohio rivers, two key commercial shipping routes, where operators have had to reduce the size of loads on barges. But one decorator in Indianapolis had found a commercial upside. He is offering to paint brown lawns green again. So we end off on a little bit of a sour humor, Dennis, but what's your take on this? And, what is your angle? What can we take from this as a lesson that we must strengthen our efforts to turn again to Almighty God for deliverance in this situation?
Nobody ever said life was easy. Life is hard, and we must survive on the planet. And to do that, you must be prepared for good times and bad times. To think that it's all going to be good times is a little foolish. So, we've had droughts before. We've had cataclysmic earthquakes and other things before, and you know what? All the humans survived. Yes, there are some people who don't survive, but in its total, humanity just keeps on going. So nature can be kind to us or it can be mean to us, but we survive. Now this segues into an item that I'm going to be reading from Maimonides later on, and that is the principle of causation. Do things happen randomly, or is there a reason behind it? Humans have always been struck by this concept of, is it me? Is it someone else? Is it really God doing all this? Or is it just happening randomly? Well, it bothered Maimonides to the point that he addressed the principle of causation. So I'll be getting into that, but anyway, it becomes a situation that, is this planned, unplanned, is it coincidence, or just a happening, or what? So we must address this so we have a better understanding, so we can understand the good times and the bad times.
Very good. Thank you, Dennis. And we're going to move on now to our next section, which has now, I think, become an important part of our presentation, because we want to integrate not just Torah wisdom, but secular wisdom educational wisdom, because this is one of the things that Rambam emphasized, and I know the Lubavitcher Rebbe also emphasizes too, that we have to take all wisdoms, wherever they may come from, and integrate them into the fullness of our understanding of the creation, ultimately with the purpose of giving more praise and to God, and to be more devoted to Him, and to fellowship more with human beings to make it a better place. So we're going to be reading now from a section from a paper that was submitted to Dr. Richard Elmore at Harvard University on January 12, 2009. From the paper was put together by what is known as the New American Academy, a new model for education, by six of the most some of the brightest minds in America right now in the field of education: Alma Aybeta, Robert Garcia, Guadalupe Guerrero, Beth Shielino Narvez, Latoya Walker, and good friend and prayer partner Shimon Warnker, who is the principal at PS 770 here in Crown Heights. So this next section is talking about a brief history of American education. So this team, the New American Academy, puts together the following information for our eyes and our ears and our hearts to peruse over. When I say eyes, obviously the paper's not in front of you, blessed souls, but meaning if you can see the wisdom that they're trying to share with the rest of us, certainly you're seeing with the eyes of your mind. So this, it goes like this. Excuse me, I'm coughing a little bit. I have a little dryness in my throat. As follows, we read, "The reason we are looking at the history of American education is that only when we understand its roots will we be able to understand why the system functions the way it does. Only then, when we can change it, once we fully understand the power dynamic at hand." Now, prior to Horace Mann, who they'll be talking about in the next page after I finish this section, prior to Horace Mann, the United States never had a system of compulsory public schooling, but rather sectarian private schools of all denominations that serve particular church interests, and a few attempts of creating common schools that would be non-denominational government schools. So Horace Mann is credited as the father of the public school system in the United States. Since the United States did not have a public school system, where did Horace Mann get his idea? And they quoted a source from Elwood P. Kuberly from a book that was written in 1920, explains the following. In the spring of 1843, Horace Mann, then secretary of the newly created State Board of Education of Massachusetts, and that was created, the State Board of Education of Massachusetts, in 1837, went on a short trip to Europe and visited schools in England, Ireland, Scotland, Prussia, Saxony, the South German states, Holland, and Belgium. One of the schools he saw, he ranked those of Prussia first. However, Horace Mann knew a few negative things about the Prussian model. The Prussian model was designed to make a nation subservient to the monarch. Horace Mann discusses his dilemma in regards to adopting the Prussian model. And this is from the writings of Horace Mann, which are captured in this book by Elmer P. Kuberly in 1920. So it reads as follows from Horace Mann. "Among the nations of Europe, Prussia has long enjoyed the most distinguished reputation for excellence of its schools. In reviews, in speeches, in tracts, and even in graver works devoted to the cause of education, its schools have been exhibited as models for imitation of the rest of the Christendom, I guess the Christian schooling system. For many years, scarce a suspicion was breathed that the general plan of education in that kingdom was not sound in theory and most beneficial in practice. Recently, however, grave charges have been preferred against it by high authority. The popular traveler Laing, it's spelled L-A-I-N-G, has devoted several chapters of his large work on Prussia to the disparagement of its school system. In 1843, numerous tracts were issued from the English press, not merely calling in question, but strongly denouncing the whole plan of education in Prussia as being not only designed to produce, but as actually producing a spirit of blind acquiescence to arbitrary power in things spiritual as well as temporal, as being, in fine, a system of education adapted to enslave and not to enfranchise the human mind. Thus we see that Horace Mann knew quite well the deficiencies of the model from its detractors, yet he continues, "But allowing all these charges against the Prussian system to be true, there were still two reasons why I'm not deterring from examining it. In the first place, the evils imputed to it were easily and naturally separable from the good which it was not desired to possess. If the Prussian schoolmaster had better methods of teaching, reading, writing, grammar, geography, arithmetic, etc., so that in half the time he produces greater and better results, meaning better students, surely we may copy his models of teaching these elements without adopting his notions of passive obedience to government or blind adherence to the articles of the church. By the ordinance of nature, the human faculties are substantially the same all over the world, and hence the best means for their development and growth in one place must be substantially the best for the development and growth everywhere." So that's where we'll leave off in terms of the reading. Now we'll get some commentary by Dennis concerning the observations of Horace Mann, a system that seemed to be working, but at the same time, too, was a system of enslavement. Now, I don't know, Dennis, the political inclinations of Mann. I mean, there was no communism back then in 1837, 1843, when Mass was the secretary of the newly created when he was the secretary of the newly created State Board of Education for Massachusetts. So we couldn't call Mann a communist. I don't know if the term fascist was even used in those days. He was an American who was trying to see what could he do to improve the American educational system, which apparently there were voices that had been aroused to say things should get better here in this country. What's your take on all this?
My take on all this is quite simple, Don. All the original houses of learning, colleges, universities in this country basically started out as an association to some religious organization or concept mm-hmm. or idea. And that was because religion teaches that you must know more, you must use your mind, and you must learn about God. Now, there's nothing wrong with that. So, to say blind adherence to religion, to me, that's not a negative thing. If you're younger than, let's say, a teenager, the blind adherence doesn't interfere with your learning. What it does mm-hmm. is teach you to focus and concentrate. Now, is that a better way of learning than saying, let's forget about all this religious stuff? And let's go on and say some state organization now has a better idea of educating people so we don't have to be aware of anything religious. So to me, and this is a personal thing, is that does public education mean it's anti-religion? Was it really intended that way? Or was it supposed to be a parallel effort of getting more people to understand and to use their mind? But if they're not using their mind for God, then what are they using it for? I don't know. I don't have the answer to that question. However, does this also mean that if education was associated with some religion, you should have education devoid of religion? That idea has never settled well with me because mm-hmm. I was brought up in a parochial system. Yes?
Right.
Blind allegiance. And if you weren't paying attention, you get a crack in the head, or the teacher would tell you to put out your hand and slap you with a ruler. And you would quickly come to attention and focus and concentrate what's going on. Now, that's the idea of spare the rod or not spare the rod.
Right.
When we were younger, we need focus and concentration, or else education doesn't work. To talk about it on a hypothetical basis, that the state is going to make it better because it's more independent and that we will educate you better, well, you sow what you reap. If you don't have people who are aware of the basics of life and think that government is now going to tell you exactly what's going on and how you should think, well, now you've gone to the other side of the pendulum. And you've taken what was a controlled atmosphere for learning into something that's wide open. And that's why we have children today in the public schools that say, I have rights. My rights are more important than the teacher. Well, that's nice. Very good. The Constitution has rights. But it wasn't meant for people who were learning who were underage. So therefore, I'm not against public education. I've gone to public schools. But we must put it in a continuum of knowledge and learning as to why we're here on the planet. And we're here to understand why we're here and what our future is. If the public schools can help us to understand that, fine. But if the public schools say, you can learn it, but you must leave this subject out, that subject out, and it goes on and on and on, and all of a sudden, we're more sensitive to the individual as opposed to what the individual's mind should be learning.
So I hear you, Dennis. You know, by the way, we've just been joined, and I'm very happy to bring him on. We have our Noah High Chassid, Ron Williams. Good morning, Ron.
Yeah, good morning. Good. Dennis and Don.
Don. Ron?
Yes. So, Ron, I'm not going to recapitulate what we've been talking about. I'll ask you just I'm not putting on hold, just to hold on until we move on to the next subject with Rambam, because it will be too long to recapitulate everything we've covered in the first 37 minutes, other than that I think we've had some interesting dialogue. You know, Dennis, what I'm thinking is this, is that, you know, I think a term that was heard a lot in the 60s, but I don't think it originated in the 60s, was that religion is the opiate for the masses. But we see here from early American history, within the first 100 years or less, 1837, so 61 years later, that the quote-unquote modern father of American education, Horace Mann, was citing that, you know, the educational systems were based on, in America, on Christian forms of education, which is obviously the integration of the belief in God, and as you mentioned, to come to know God, and at the same time too, there was the natural sciences were developing. I mean, chemistry was developing. By 1848, pasteurization became a modern word in the mindset of human beings, and I'm sure that word made its way very quickly to the American continent after Louis Pasteur made his discovery. That actually, at the unique phase in American history, is that the religion or the faith-based theologies were actually a way of opening up the minds of the masses. So I found that very interesting that say, like 100 plus years later in the 1960s or wherever that statement came from, that religion is the opiate of masses, it was basically foisted by people who wouldn't mind, perhaps, if the mindset of the masses were actually dumbed down. Because the intent, according to this historical perspective, is that the religious-based educations were actually, you know, and they even cites the Prussian model, although the Prussian model gets an unfavorable review in this paper by the New American Academy. But one thing they cannot deny is that there was some success in training the school children. I just want to mention one more thing, is that in the field that I've been in mental health and empowering individuals with emotional days of adolescence, one of the things that we were taught is that children and young adults, adolescents, and even as we get older into middle age, we need structure in order to function properly. And if there's not a certain set structure in a school system, and you said, you know, the child's rights, which there's a certain level where they do have rights, but, you know, the society should also expect that if the child or the human being wants their rights, they should accept along with those rights the responsibilities of exercising their rights in a prudent fashion, as opposed to, unfortunately, this horrible tragedy took place in Aurora, Colorado, where that person exercised his right to be a mass murderer. Any comments on that, Dennis?
Yes, what happens is I get a little rattled when I hear the word new. Not that I'm against new, but I can't accept new unless you tell me what was wrong with the old. If the old worked and survived for a long time with humans, why all of a sudden, why must we do the new thing? So I'm for the new thing, but it must be fit into the understanding, and it must be an extension of the old. You cannot dump on the old because you just came out with something new. And we can't keep going on like this, because what we're doing is we're like reinventing old, only we're calling it new, only without the principles and understanding that we had originally. So here we are again. You just mentioned this thing in Colorado. I mean, the guy who did it was a very intelligent guy. He planned it out. He bought legal weapons. He bought legal bullets and everything. And what happens? We treat it as a tragedy. Why? Because our system has failed us. If this guy was well-educated and he planned this out, he was doing the work of the devil. So let's not pretend that this is a simple psychological problem. It is not. It is pervasive, and it's anti-human, no matter how you look at it. And when are we going to stand up and say, let's cut the nonsense?
True. As I understand, he was a student. He was working on a PhD in neuroscience. So obviously he was a thinker, but somewhere along the way, his thinking went, he crossed over into the border of inhumane and devilish behavior. And I don't even know. I even lost track of the death count as of this morning, but I heard that he's as young as a 4-month-old was injured from the shooting. So such a, I mean, this is unforgivable type of wanton violence that was perpetrated.
I just interrupt this, Don, because getting back to causation, do things happen for a purpose, or are they random, or are they by coincidence?
Right.
Ironically, he was using an automatic weapon. The automatic weapon jammed. If it didn't jam, you'd maybe have 2 or 3 times the amount of people who died or were injured.
Hmm. So, you know, Dennis, I think this is the time to segue to something a little more positive, because we don't want to dwell on the negative. So where do you want to take us now as we go into, further into our explanations of Moses Maimonides, physician, scientist, and philosopher?
Okay. We're going up to page 105, Don. And
I'm there.
Okay. And it's at the heading of the page says, Maimonides on the Distinction Between Science and Pseudoscience by J. David Blitch. Maimonides does not present a systematic exposition of his understanding of the notion of causality. Nevertheless, he certainly understood and accepted the principle of causal relationship between empirical events. Causality is clearly invoked in this discussion of divine attributes, critique of Kalam philosophy, proof of the existence, unity, and incorporeality of God, creation, prophecy, good and evil, divine knowledge and will, and also in his philosophy of law, as well as his formulation of the Tamei HaMitzvah, the purpose of rationale understanding of various divine commandments. Maimonides certainly believed that the universe is governed by the set of physical laws. To speak of the universe as governed by a set of laws is but another way of stating that the physical phenomena occur in an orderly and predictable manner. This formulation, in turn, is actually a good working definition of the notion of causation, i.e., the principle that affirms that physical events are not merely isolated and discrete individual occurrences, happen to occur in a certain chronological order, but there is a certain intrinsic connection between them that such, derides parabus, a Latin term, the occurrence of one will necessarily and invariably lead to another. However, while the notion of causality as an intrinsic and necessary relationship between otherwise independent events may be a priori concept inherent in the human intellect, specific instances of cause and effect relationships may not always be immediately discoverable. In other cases, the existence of the causal relationship may be debatable. Philosophy may posit the existence of such a relationship, but it is science that must provide the insensations. It is certainly arguable that for Judaism, causality is not simply a philosophy construct of entirely speculative interest, but it is part of the anexology framework upon which halachic or halakha is predicated. The Jew is commanded to eat matzah on Passover, but matzah does not descend from manna from heaven. The obligation to eat matzah on Passover carries with it an obligation to prepare unleavened bread to be eaten on the festival. Implied in that commandment is the empirical principle that when flour is mixed with water and when kneaded and substantially placed in a heated oven, matzah, rather than porridge, will emerge. Implied in this positive commandment requiring physical artifacts for their fulfillment is the notion that man is capable of producing or fashioning such artifacts. Man is not required to engage in random activity in the pious hope that somehow his haphazard action will yield the necessary object, such as the golden calf emerged from Aaron's bonfire, but to act in an orderly, purposeful manner, fully confident that the endeavor, properly executed, will yield the anticipated result. Man is, in effect, commanded to accept the principle of causation. Otherwise, he would plead impotence in failing to fulfill the mitzvah imposed upon him. The principle of causality is certainly reflected in Maimonides' formulation of the principle that all measures must be taken, whether in a therapeutic context or a non-therapeutic situation. I'd like to skip forward here to a quote from Maimonides. It says, in light of these enunciated principles, Maimonides' statement in Aliyah Shabbat is problematic. The issue is whether or not an amulet may be worn on the Sabbath while passing from a private to a public domain. Maimonides' rules. One may go out with a tested amulet. What is a tested amulet? One which has cured three persons, or which has been made by a person who has cured three persons by means of other amulets. Maimonides' codification reflects the ruling in the Mishnah, Shabbat 60a, and the ensuing discussion of the Jeremiah, Shabbat 61a, and is predicated upon the acceptance of the curative powers of amulets when prepared by persons proficient in such matters.
Wow. I mean, there's a lot here to go over, but I like to make it nice and simple. Is that, unfortunately, in the modern world where people's minds are unfortunately brainwashed into seeing simple cause and effect relationships as promoted in mass media, then they seem to say when they should turn off the television, or they used to call it in my day the boob tube, you know, because it's, I don't know, more likely than not, the television is not the wisdom tube, except if it's broadcasting true wisdom, that people then can think that they can connect the dots, you know, in their own personal lives based on, unfortunately, their subconscious and conscious acceptance of cause and effect relationships, say, like in mass media. And here, like this example you just cited from the reading of this book, Dennis, The Amulet. Now, first of all, I want to mention that today no one basically uses this anymore. So it, even though that was something that was more evident in the days of Rambam, which is 800 years ago, that it was based on his analysis, based on other sources in the oral Torah, what should be done in terms of whether a person can carry that amulet. Now, we're not going to go into why is it important for a person to carry or not to carry. That's relating more to Jewish observance of the Shabbos. But the fact that Rambam was someone, in his humility, would say, well, you have to follow. You would say, almost like a scientific basis for determining if a person can, in fact, walk out with this amulet. And I think that, you know, I've been talking with friends that, because unfortunately, I think that not enough people are thinking about what's going on in terms of this drought. Maybe it's a sense of denial. Maybe it's because of what happened over the last week. Maybe it's just that they'd rather watch a baseball game. But I'd like to turn to Dennis, and to Ron Williams on this matter. But before that, we have a caller in. I don't recognize the area code. I apologize if you've been on the show before. Can you please identify yourself, caller? From the 325 area code.
Oh, Don, this is Julie.
Julie Taylor?
Yes, Julie Taylor from Texas.
Good morning, Julia. Very thank you for joining us. So, Julie, we'd like to get your thoughts on this matter, cause and effect relations. But first, I'd like to go to Ron. Ron, what is your advice for people who want to try to connect the dots, perhaps before it's too premature to connect the dots in terms of things that go on in their lives and trying to perhaps investing more time in realizing everything is coming from Hashem? I mean, it's not an easy question to answer, to ask of you, but I think that you can sum it up for within your experience and learning and living a life as a Noahide, how you understand divine providence and cause and effect relationships in your own personal life. You don't have to get too personal with it. You know, just gloss over for the blessed souls listening. What's your take on these matters?
Oh, by the way, welcome, Julie, for joining us this morning. I remember you from before, so thank you for coming back on the show. Okay. My personal take on this would be that to connect an effect to a cause, it requires a massive amount of wisdom. You must understand things on a level which right now we're basically not able to do so. As a result, it's connecting the dots many times may be premature and sometimes even lead to misunderstanding. In terms of divine providence according to my understanding, it's like sort of kind of like an umbrella that in which when you connect to the Creator and you start doing His will, there's a certain amount of guidance, which leads to, I wouldn't say protection, but it guides you on that path where you are not subjected to a lot of the certain mishaps that, if you're not careful in your behavior, actually is a direct reflection of your behavior. I mean, I could just relate it by a common example. If you're driving and you're not careful and you go to a red light, you get into an accident, you know, this came basically from your negligence.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to constantly be aware of your behavior. And that's like the first step in terms of avoiding certain things from happening and then relating it to some cause that, you know, you're unaware of. But in Psalm 18, by King David, he said, God acts with you in accordance with your deeds. As a result, let me get that Psalm for you to read exactly what is written there. In Psalm 18, verses 25, it says that Hashem, the Lord, will pay me in accordance with my righteousness, according to the cleanliness of my hands before His eyes. Because with the devout you act devoutly, with the wholehearted man you act wholeheartedly, with the pure you act purely, with the crooked you act perversely. So we see here that man's actions does have a way of reflecting how the Creator acts with him. So ultimately, we have to refine our actions. We must take responsibility for whatever we do in this world. And, you know, just acknowledge the fact that Hashem is the one who is in charge of everything. And all that comes to us, it is ultimately for our benefit. Whether it's to help us to improve or just to help us to even just change the direction in which our life is going. So this is basically, you know, a quick summary of what that question has done us.
Thank you. And Julia, now you're in Texas, right?
Yes, sir.
Yes. Now, I think there's cotton grown in Texas. What other crops are grown in Texas? And what is the talk in the state of Texas in terms of the crop yields this coming summer or early fall in relation to the lack of rain?
Well, we grow cotton. A lot of it is cotton. We grow a lot of maize. Then the maize is it's not corn maize. It's a different maize. I'm trying to think of what it's called right now, but it's a grain. There's some wheat. But yeah, we've had more rain here than I think in the Midwest states, and more than we did last year when we had all the fires. So, but right now we're not having any rain, so it's kind of up in the air of how things are going to go. They're having to draw on the aquifers and the well waters, and they haven't been completely replenished yet. So it's very questionable of what it's going to be like if we don't start getting some more rain.
In your neck of the woods down in Texas, are there any public calls for public prayer, or are the faith-based communities asking people to think about offering up more prayers to God in these matters?
Well, I haven't heard any as much as I have in the past. There was, on the news, a lot of the churches were asking for prayer and having meetings and saying everybody could come down to the Paseo, which is the park, and pray together and stuff like that. But this year, that's been in the past. This year, I really haven't noticed it like it should be. I'm sure there is call for prayer, but I don't think it's kind of like you said earlier, everybody's kind of gone on their own way now that the major scare is not at hand, so people aren't as concerned, and they're doing other things besides talking to God.
Mm-hmm. I hear you. Thank you. Now, what's your take, Julia? I mean, in your life, or what you've observed in the lives of others, is there a tendency to try to connect the dots and cause and effect relationships, or is there a greater tendency to say, well, you know, this is from God, and you know, until someone can clarify for us, was identified as an extremely highly spiritual person or a prophet, as we might call them, certain things are just better left for us to try to just leave it up to the providence of the Most High. I mean, what is your personal take on this on cause and effect relationships, or we just put total reliance on God, which is, you know, to try to find cause and effect relationships in our personal lives is not necessarily denying God's individual providence over every aspect of our life.
Right. Well, it's funny that you should ask, and we should be talking on this conversation. I just came back from a wonderful visit with my cousin that I haven't seen in a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And in Dallas, Fort Worth area, and she is of Christian religion, Baptist,
mm-hmm.
And I don't know. I tried to get a feel of what she thought and how she thought, and we kind of clashed. And I hope I didn't hurt her feelings, but it was about how she felt about things that are happening, about, you know, and I said, well, I don't, and she told me, oh, I don't believe in people preaching doom and gloom. I said, well, I'm not preaching doom and gloom. I'm just, do you see things, how things are happening, why they're happening, what's, you know, can you, you know, maybe, like you say, connect the dots. And and I said, I know a lot of times with me, I will see something that I know I'm not supposed to say or do something, and there's times I don't go 24 hours without getting some kind of notification, either something on Facebook that somebody has put on a blog, and it's there staring me in the face, Lashon Hara, don't do that, you know, or whatever it is that, you know, we're not supposed to do. It's, you know, as an example, you know, I don't know. I see it as divine intervention, but I think some people, like my cousin, they don't, I don't know. They just want to let it go.
Right.
Let it be.
I hear you. I hear you. Dennis, before we move on, we're going to do a couple more presentations of Rambam. Any final thoughts on these offerings of thought by Ron and Julia?
Well, I like Julia's idea of divine intervention. What happens is, what would the world be without divine intervention?
Why is that?
I mean, let's look at the other side of the coin. I mean, we would have 50 million questions and we'd use our rationalization to come up with answers that may or may not be right. We'd have no way of measuring them, no standards to be set, and we'd lack a lot of understanding. So is there divine intervention? Well, whether we know it, see it, or believe it, there happens to be a guiding hand. Because nature, it follows cycles. These cycles are not random. If we're going to have a hard time in life, we're going to have a good time, but it evens out over the long run. And just like we talked about before, we even mentioned the amulets. You said there's people not using amulets anymore, Don. I agree with you until I went to Turkey a year or two ago. And everybody's going around with a God's eye. They have it in their wallets. Well, women carry it in their purse, their bags, and they're wearing things around their neck, and they have little things hidden called a God's eye. And I was just shocked that so many people were doing this because they didn't even want to leave their house without making sure they had a God's eye and some part of their body. Now, to me, I was just totally shocked to think that a God's eye would have such meaning to people who are not basically... I have a hard time explaining this, but I experienced it. But to me, it was that these people felt like that if you didn't have God's eye with you, you were unprotected. Well, that's a nice concept, but just like Julia said, is there divine intervention? There has to be a guiding hand somewhere. And if we ignore it, it's our fault.
I agree with you, Dennis. When I mentioned the idea of amulet, I was saying within the Jewish, say, Torah observing community, generally speaking, is not considered within the normative thrust or vein or parameters of how Judaic teachings are learned and observed today, that it could be observed by the members of the nations, because I don't do those type of studies, who uses an amulet or not outside of the nation of Israel. So, you know, if you know, also, you know, I just want to mention as a tangential idea, I once heard this from a psychiatrist talking about the effectiveness of psychotropic medication for people with mental illness. And he said that the rate of success in double-blind studied tests on the placebo effect with sugar pills as opposed to the medicine itself, he said, well, the rates had been rising. At his point, it was up to 29% effectiveness using a sugar pill when the patient thought the medication they were taking was as prescribed by the doctor. And then a couple of years later, I went to another lecture where the effectiveness went up to 33%. But going back to that previous, the psychiatrist who I originally heard him discuss this matter, in his good conscience, he couldn't prescribe a medication, or a sugar pill as it may be, as in those studies that he cited, because it only had a 31% effectiveness. So, you know, hopefully when they prescribe such medication, there's 50% and more percent in halavite, 90%. Unfortunately, though, it's not that high. You know, there is this idea that you try to work with what is most effective. And in these more ancient, older cultures where perhaps there's more of an emphasis on faith-based practice in the place of, say, more rational, quote-unquote, scientific reasoning, if it works for them, or at least it maintains a certain level of stability within that culture, then let's say if it doesn't work, at least they know they've tried, and perhaps they'll humble themselves to seek other means of whatever forms of protection they need, which will hopefully be kosher forms. I'd like to move on to the teachings of Maimonides by Jacob S. Mintgen as an addition to what Ron shared, and then give an example of what we're going to be talking about in this following section. And this is a wonderful book which is published by Aronson. And it says the following: most of Maimonides' literary work was devoted to Jewish law. He had been bred to the subject because his father was a dayan, a Jewish religious judge, who saw to it that his son learned the whole of rabbinic literature. Maimonides turned his genius in this subject first to an interpretation of the Mishnah, which is the core text of the Talmud. The six volumes of the Mishnah are a code of Jewish law based on thousands of rabbinic interpretations of the Bible and other rabbinic traditions. It was composed in the second century, we're talking about the Mishnah, in Israel by Rabbi Judah the Prince, who was then acknowledged the head of Jewry. During the next nine centuries, in Babylonia and Israel, the Mishnah was studied and interpreted by scholars who often disagreed among themselves. The discussions took place in the major Jewish centers during the early three centuries and were recorded in two collections. There was the Babylonian Talmud and the Jerusalem Talmud. For the next six centuries, scholars and religious judges studied these enormous commentaries, especially the Babylonian Talmud, and added to them. By the time of Maimonides, which is around like the 12th century, in the early 13th century, I believe, the 11th century going into the early 12th century, by the time of Maimonides, this legal corpus had grown so large that only scholars could find their way through its labyrinths. The original meaning of the core text, the Mishnah, had thus been obscured by generations of interpretation. So Maimonides wrote his commentary on the Mishnah in Arabic, and he constantly tried to recover the meaning as intended by Rabbi Judah. So we then return now, to a legal ruling by Maimonides concerning the place of where the altar was in the temple. And this is in Chapter 2, Law 2 of the Mishnah Torah by Rambam's Laws of the Chosen House, which is talking about what is the oral Torah tradition combined with the scriptural information about the Holy Temple, the Beit HaMikdash. So Rambam writes as follows: it is universally accepted that the place in which King David and Solomon built the altar, which was on the threshing floor of Ornan, is the location where Abraham built the altar in which he prepared Isaac for sacrifice. Noah also built an altar on that location when he left the ark. It was also the place of the altar in which Cain and Abel brought sacrifices. Similarly, Adam, the first man, offered a sacrifice there and was created at that very spot. As our sages said, quote, man was created from the place where he would find atonement, which is in the Rambam and in the commentaries, it's mentioned that many righteous people throughout the generations were aware of this altar site, and not only just were the righteous, but also the people who had followed idolatrous practices, living in the land of Israel before the conquest by the Israelite nation, were also aware of the site. So it was, you know, it was not just known to the Jewish people. It was known from those who followed the traditions. And we underestimate how much traditions were passed down from Adam and then to his son Cain and Abel was killed, but then to his son Sheth, and then to Hanoch and Methuselah and Noah and Lamech, the father of Noah, and then to Abram, Isaac, and Jacob. So I'm saying, Rambam just saying very, very matter-of-factly that this is why the place where they had the altar in the first and second temple, when the Jewish people had dedicated such an area for such services, that this was basically going all the way back to the time of original man, who was formed there according to the viewpoints of the sages of Israel, and also to share with us this concept from where we were created, from the space or the place we were created, we would find atonement. Any one of you want to comment on this teaching by Rambam? Ron?
No. I have no comment.
Well,
so you know, yes, Dennis.
What happens is humans, when they make decisions, usually rely on what people did before them. And we sort of respect that if that's what they did and it worked, why can't it work for us? So it isn't a question that all of a sudden we reinvent things. We use what our forefathers and their forefathers used as measures of standards. So therefore, if by doing that, we honor what they did prior to us. So it's not unusual from a human viewpoint to say we're going to follow what people did before us. Unless you got a better idea, we'll go with the old one. Mm-hmm. So Maimonides basically said, if you want to honor what people have done prior to your life, you honor them by honoring the things they did.
True. So that being said, yes, Julia, yes, you want to say something?
Yes, I kind of would like to add something on to that is also if for someone who, and this is again where I think divine intervention comes in, like in, for instance, my case, I've known different things as a child, and I left, you know, religion basically for a while and went out into the world because I felt, you know, unworthy, basically. But then I started questioning and coming back and searching and truly looking for the truth. And it's amazing how not only that you when you start looking for the truth, it's like it finds you as well.
I like that.
You find out. You may not know these people at one time, but when you start really studying and digging deep into the roots, you find the fathers. This is what they did. And this is what happened, and this is how they were blessed. And you're like, well, I'm sorry, I've forgotten your name. The other gentleman was saying, you know, we see what happened to them, so we go with the fathers and what they did.
You're referring to Dennis Ryan. Thank you, Julia. Now, Julia, Dennis, and Ron, Dennis, and Julia. We now would like to take a musical break. It's a little bit of a fun break, a little light-hearted song, which most of us are familiar with from the 50s or the 70s when someone did another version of it. This is an a cappella version by the students at YU called "The Lion Sleeps Tonight." Of course, there's not any music accompaniment. We're going to try to be a little sensitive from now until next Monday to refrain from playing any of our humble efforts music with a musical instrument accompaniment because of the strictness according to Jewish tradition. But this comes up pretty well. It's called "The Lion Sleeps Tonight" by the YU Yeshiva University a cappella band. Hold on, everyone. And you notice the lead singer hits quite a high note. First, he might even sound like a woman, but no, this is a man. I'm looking at the video of him, and he's got a yarmulke on his head, not a wig. Hold on, everyone.
Amen.
That was posted about 4 years ago. And we'd like to move on now. We have on our show live co-host Julia Tellier from the great state of Texas, Dennis Ryan and Ron Williams. And I'd like to start off, as I usually do after we go to our halfway point, although we're a little way past the halfway point, to start with a teaching from Rabbi Nachman of Breslov. And he says the following: although eternal life may be attained even in the present state of reality, It will primarily characterize the future when spiritual knowledge will increase. At that time, everyone will know God, and through this knowledge, everyone will be incorporated into the divine oneness. Then all creatures will live forever like God. For by knowing God, everyone will be incorporated into Him. As the wise man remarked, talking about the Khazari, in chapter 5, teaching number 21, quote, "If I knew him, I would be him," end of quote. This spiritual knowledge will be in the future, as indicated by the verse in the prophecy of Isaiah, chapter 11, verse 9, "The earth will be full of knowledge of God." Because of this knowledge, nothing will be lacking. Thus the Mishnah states, if you possess knowledge, what do you lack? And if you lack knowledge, what do you possess? And the quote is coming from the Vayikra Rabbah. This is a Midrash teaching from the third book, based on the third book of the Torah of Leviticus. Everything will be completely good. The Noahides, the children of Noah, the nations of the world will know God through this increase in spiritual knowledge, each person according to his own level, and to whatever extent he exert himself to serve God in this world. This is implied by the prophet's metaphor that the future knowledge of the Most High will be like, quote, "the waters that fill the sea," end of quote. The sea is one, yet due to the ocean's floor, it is deeper in one place than another. Thus, it shall be in the future, the depth of each person's knowledge of God will vary according to the nature and the extent of his previous efforts in divine service. All of humanity will then live forever, for the knowledge of God will be revealed, and everybody will be incorporated in the divine oneness. Thus, on the verse, in Zechariah 14:9, "On that day, God will be one in his name, one." Our sages asked, is he now not one? But presently the blessing we recite upon hearing bad news is, "Blessed be the true judge." Whereas upon hearing good news, we say, blessed is the beneficent one, one who does good. However, in the future world, the latter blessing will be said at all times. This is because in the future, when knowledge is revealed, it will be known that evil does not really exist. Rather, everything is good and everything is one. Even the experience of exile is only due to our lack of spiritual knowledge. As the verse states in Isaiah 5:13, therefore I have exiled my people who have no knowledge. This is also why the redemption of Egyptian bondage came through Moses, since according to our tradition, Moses was the greatest of the prophets of Israel. He personified the aspect of knowledge. Thus it is written, quote, you will know that I am God who brings you out from under the subjugation of Egypt, as is written in Exodus chapter 6, verse 7. For the main redemption is attained through knowledge, and this is a teaching from Rabbi Nachman of Breslov from his classic work, Lukuti Maharan, chapter 1, 21, sections 11 through 13, abridged. So let's go around the board. Ron, this idea of becoming one with Hashem, with God, through gaining spiritual knowledge, or as we call it, Torah knowledge. What's your take on this?
Well, first of all, to love someone, you must know them. And in knowing and in acquiring that knowledge, you're better able to understand them. Once you start understanding, you kind of start acquiring them to a certain extent. And this is what we do when we start to acquire knowledge of the Creator, which is basically based in the Torah, which he gives to Moses on Mount Sinai. But this is the only source of his knowledge. And now it has been brought down. And today we start the weekly portion of the Torah that we read. We start the book of Deuteronomy. And it says that the book of Deuteronomy was written by Moses. It was sort of like his summation of the first four books that were given directly from God. And it said the book of Deuteronomy, it may seem to be at a disadvantage because it was given by Moses as opposed to the five four. But it has the interface of a human, which has been brought down even more to our level. And what happens is when we acquire this knowledge, we're able to understand the wisdom of the Creator and as such become one with Him through knowing Him.
Thank you, Ron. Dennis, the idea of getting to become one to attain a certain level of oneness through the acquisition of the knowledge of Him.
Well,
what do you think on that?
The word knowledge here is, I think, being overemphasized a bit, Don, because if you can't love God, then what are you going to do with all your knowledge? You can be the smartest person in the world, but if you don't have a communication with God, how smart are you really? There's assumptions being made here that if you get more knowledge, you'll be closer to God. But without the love, where is the connection? Because that's like saying a scientist is closer to God than a holy man because the scientist knows more. Wrong. What happens is, you would think that the scientist would be getting closer to God because he knows more. Unfortunately, science for science sake says love is an emotion. It's not part of science. However, the holy man says, I feel better, I believe better, and I have faith in the Lord, and I try to help out other people. Now, I'm not saying one is good, one is bad. I'm just saying that where is the emphasis placed? If you place too much emphasis on knowledge, are you taking it away from love? Or is someone making the assumption that the first commandment says, you must love God?
I hear you. Julia, I'll respond to that in a moment. Julia, you're taking this matter. Where do you see the factor of knowing God, getting knowledge of Him, with becoming one with Him?
Well, I'm kind of like, I kind of agree with Dennis. I think you have to have some kind of acceptance of God to begin with, and then the knowledge follows suit. And then I think, and when the knowledge builds, your love builds. If you, it, you have a, you have to have a relationship with God. If you don't talk and you don't listen, there's no relationship. If it's a one-sided thing, something, it, it kind of stagnates.
I hear you. I hear you. So, so my response is this, that when we, as we the nation Israel, perceive from our teachings and our traditions about what the Messianic era is that one of the things that the increase that we'll see in the good is that there will be an increase of wisdom. Now, in order for there to be that increase of wisdom, okay, we do have a verse from, I think it's from Solomon. It's either in Solomon in Proverbs or King David. I think actually it's Solomon in Proverbs, where the beginning of all wisdom is the fear of God. Meaning, when we walk into this courtyard of trying to gain knowledge of the Most High, which is afforded to us most gracefully and most mercifully and lovingly by a Creator who definitely loves us because He gives us life. And I equate being given life as an act of love by the one who gives me life. That we have to take, yes, a certain set of core values to attach to that knowledge, that the knowledge doesn't grow rancid and start to be used for self-aggrandizement. And basically those are the features of love and fear. And not only that, the humility to accept upon ourselves that we have been granted a entranceway into developing a relationship. I mean, when a child is born and they're interacting with their young mother and father, there's not an intellectual type of relationship yet formed by the child. In fact, you know, it takes a couple of years for the child to develop their faculties of speech, aside from Google Gaga. But when the child looks at the parents, there's an inner, natural type of yearning to want to be with the father, and how much more so to be with the mother, because, you know, for many babies, if not most babies, the mother is the primary source of food in the beginning of the infant's life. So when we look at that we are, so to speak, we are adults and we have active minds that can lead us in the right way and also be lead us in the wrong way if the ego gets involved. Therefore, as a means of girding our spiritual loins and guiding us in the right direction as we encounter, hopefully each day, new information about the Creator and His creation, the Torah teachings can afford us, we are tempered and we are harnessed and we are bridled. The bit is put to our mouth, so to speak, spiritually speaking, that there has to be a love of Him. There has to be a fear, meaning we should not go and start to... The accessing new ideas in Torah is not on the condition that we feel that we're better than another person. Actually, it says by Moses that Moses was the humblest man who lived out on the face of the earth. And yet Moses was the one who received the divine instruction. How do you put the two together? You would think he was the most elevated human being, or he was the most self-aggrandized human being. No. We see that Moses gives us an instruction. That's why I go back to Rabbi Nachman, what he mentioned here, that's the reason why the redemption from Egypt came to Moses, because he personified the aspect of knowledge. But we're also told later on, in the Torah, he was the humblest of all men. So whether you want to say, you make whatever equation you feel comfortable with, whether you have to love God, whether there is a commandment to love Him or to fear Him, but the aspect of humility, which we say, from where should we get this humility? Well, we can see someone who accessed a level of Torah that none of us shall ever get in our lifetimes, someone who had accessed the entire realm of Torah teachings from the Most High Moses, it didn't make him the most haughty man on the earth. It actually made him the most humble person upon the face of the earth. With that being said, I want to turn now to compassion for humanity in the Jewish tradition. And this is talking about the concept of enlightenment. This is by Rabbi David Sears, a book I heavily recommend to everyone. Again, it's published by Aronson. And he quotes from, it was taught in the house of Elijah, and I think Ron Williams on more than one occasion has brought up this teaching, but I think it's something we should remind everyone as much as possible. The prophet Elijah declared, I call heaven and earth to bear witness that anyone, Jew or Noahide, man or woman, slave or handmaid, if your deeds or her deeds are worthy, divine spirit will rest upon him or her. And the next teaching from the Rogachev Gaon, the great sage of Rogachev who lived in the 20th century, citing from the Jerusalem Talmud, and the glory of the Lord will be revealed and all flesh shall see it together, from Isaiah 40, verse 5. The term all flesh comes to include the Noahides as well. The Jerusalem Talmud states, quote, when one hears a divine name blasphemed by an Israelite or a Noahide, one must tear one's garments. Which verse proves this? As it says in Jeremiah 32:27, I am the God, the Lord of all flesh. Again, I'll read that again from Jeremiah 32:27. I am the God, I am God, the Lord of all flesh. And concluding, and then I'll let Dennis and Ron and Julia add their comments as per their interest. Finally, pulling from Joel chapter 3, verse 1, the prophet Joel, and afterward I shall pour forth my spirit upon all flesh, and all your sons and daughters will prophesy, your elders will dream dreams, your youth will see visions. And the Matsuda David, one of the rabbinical commentators, comments on, I shall pour forth my spirit. This refers to the spirit of wisdom and apprehension of godliness upon all flesh. This is including all the nations of the world who will come to discern and know God. So, Ron, you want to lead the way and give your comments on these teachings?
No, I actually give it over to Dennis so he can start.
Okay, Dennis, volley over to Dennis from Ron.
I'm always impressed with Moses. You mentioned that he was the humblest man on the earth. Unfortunately, most of us humans have a hard time putting our ego to rest because we're told that to survive, you got to use your ego. But if you're going to survive, how are you going to put your ego to rest so that you can use humility and be on a better communicating plane with the Lord? If you don't have humility, then where is the love that's associated with God? In other words, we as humans are always trying to strive, but as it was quoted in Psalms regarding life, and I'll quote it, this is a test. This is a test about everything we do. And if you forget about the test, then you're living on your own. But because it is a test, we must be humble. Because we don't know everything, we can't understand everything, and yet we're asked to believe and have faith in a supernatural being. Most people would say, you try to do that, it sounds like a crazy idea or a crazy notion. No, it isn't. Mm-hmm. If you understand the basic parts of humanity and the relation to our Creator, it is not crazy. It is not supernatural. The Lord may be supernatural, but we have to deal with the reality. But this is a test. Make no bones about it, and you can't get away from it. And I just want to say one thing about Julia. Julia, you are not alone. There are a lot of people similar to your case, so to speak. You called it a case. But your circumstances, a lot of other humans share. But you got to remember that there's always a chance that, yes, you can change, you can reinvent yourself, and you can always love God. And by the way, that's the reason why we have this program, is to be able to communicate and talk about our human frailties, and does it have any meaning, or is there any purpose to it?
Yes, thank you. Julia, would you like to make any comments?
No, yes and no. Thank you, Ron. I appreciate that. Thank you very much. And, but, yeah, I think that's how we grow. We grow from each other. I mean, that goes back, I mean, to all the commandments, all the 613, the 10, whatever anybody goes by. You have to it's basic. Love God with all your heart, all your soul, your mind, and love each other. If we can't do even one of them, we can't do the other.
True. Very, very, very true. We'd like to move on now to, as we are accustomed to, a book that I know is near and dear to Ron, and I also love it myself. It's called The Path of the Righteous Gentile, authored by Rabbis Chaim Klorfin and Rabbi Yaakov Rogalski. And we're in the section now of the Seven Laws of the Children of Noah, Chapter 4. And we'll read as following. And it's very interesting here that this following teaching corresponds to as it would apply to Jewish young adults as well. So it goes as follows, and maybe Ron will want to comment on this. It is a matter of dispute as to when a person becomes responsible for his or her actions under these laws, meaning the teachings of the seven Noahide commandments. One opinion holds that it depends on the intellectual development of the individual. According to this opinion, as soon as a child has attained the maturity to understand the meaning and significance of the seven universal laws, he is obligated to the fullest extent of the law. The other opinion is that a boy reaches the age of legal responsibility at his 13th birthday, as a Jewish boy does, and a girl at her 12th birthday, as it is in Jewish law. So the idea of responsibility, whether it be according to intellectual development or simply falling under the guidelines of chronological development in terms of reaching the 13th year of a young man or the 12th year of a young woman. So, Ron, would you like to comment on these matters? And have you heard anything by Rabbi Rogalski about these matters? And then I'd like to chime in, of course, after hearing maybe what Dennis or Julia have to say about this teaching.
You know, it says here that one opinion holds that it depends on the intellectual development of the individual. And I think many times we see that now with certain crimes being perpetrated by people who are not fully aware, not fully developed and matured mentally. And we see here that it's an all-encompassing type of discussion in which we address, you know, both the mature and the immature being. And I know, for example, one of my friends at work, he mentioned that he was a juror and he couldn't understand why this case was brought before a judge when the guy was completely guilty. He was found with the weapon and everything.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember, you know, making a suggestion that maybe the reason is because the type of maturity and the type of environment in which the person had been brought up in caused a kind of a distortion of his understanding of what's right and wrong. And that's one of the reasons why, you know, you have this whole procession of, you know, going in front of a judge and have attorneys, you know, argue back and forth why a person deserves whatever they know to receive. So that's just, you know, one of the ideas here that, you know, we should always keep in mind when we think about rendering judgment on another person in terms of their maturity.
Mm-hmm. I hear you. Dennis, what's your take on a person reaching a legal age, as defined here, or an age according to their intellectual development?
Well, you said it before in one of your statements from one of the rabbis there that the teaching was that it may vary from individual to individual. If it varies so much, and we know humans vary, how can we get them all to conform to anything? However, even though we have variations, we have basic or fundamental things that are inherent in our beings. And those are the things that we try to measure people by. Again, I bring up humility and love and other things like that that sometimes seem elusive, but yet everybody has it, but we're all different. We all have different fingerprints, but our minds are made of the same composition, and they can act the same way. So therefore, we do have a lot in common, and unfortunately, we emphasize our differences, when in effect, humanity would be served better if we emphasized what we have in common. Because then we'd know what we have to make up or what we're lacking to make everybody love us or be loved. If we're not practicing it, we're ignoring it.
I hear. Yep. Julia, any thoughts on these matters?
Well, I kind of agree with Ron and Dennis both. I know in Native American history, a boy becomes a man, and it is also amazingly at the age of 13, and a girl becomes a woman at the age of 12 as well. So I think if we didn't have or didn't set limits for the majority of people, then, you know, or not limits, what's the word I want to use? Goals or certain times for a certain goal, that the majority of people fit into that particular area, but there's some that excel and exceed that before that time frame, and there's some that don't. So I think it depends on the individual has to come through. And I think at this time of stage of the world that we live in, we're in a fallen world. And there, if, you know, I think we're all, I mean, even though it makes it even harder to accomplish our goals, I think.
I hear you. I know it. Well, we have a teaching that right before the crack of dawn is the darkest point of the night, even though at a moment's notice we're already seeing the crack of dawn, the sun rays starting to peek over, not necessarily the horizon, but in a way that we sense, the darkness is leaving. These are very, very deep issues, and it just basically, again, we are not here to form ultimate conclusions for other people and the choices they have to make, but merely to humbly share this information so they can hopefully feel empowered in their own personal explorations upon life upon this blessed earth. With that being said, we're going to go now into the final section of today's humble efforts, and we're going back to Genesis chapter 2, verse 16. As it said, I'm sorry, Genesis 2:15, where it is written that God placed man, and he took man and placed him in the Garden of Eden to serve it or to dress it and to guard it. And from the Hasidic perspective, we're drawing from a teaching from Lubavitcher Rebbe, from something called Lakuti Sikhas, Volume 7, that the first responsibility that was placed upon humanity, which is basically to work or dress up the Garden of Eden and to protect it, that this underscores as well a lesson that we could learn about human psychology, meaning how our mindsets, our consciousness are constructed. That if we were placed in a garden from the beginning with all our common ancestors, Adam and Eve, because if Adam was placed in the garden, Eve was right there along with him. It's just not written there explicitly, but it didn't say that he left the garden even to take a wife. In fact, his wife was formed out of his own rib inside the Garden of Eden. That work and activity are, in fact, an intrinsic part of our human unique makeup, not just an answer to our needs. So when humanity, meaning Adam and Eve, originally man and woman, existing in the Garden of Eden, they had all their needs provided for, and they actually were in a state of imposed perfection, because the Creator was all of perfection, allowed them to be in a state of perfection until, unfortunately, they engaged in that original sin. But yet still, in that pristine condition where we were placed, God directed us, meaning our ancestors, which is indirectly upon all of us, to work and improve the world. And by the way, last but not least, we should try to improve ourselves. So therefore, no individual or community, as it may be, no matter how that community manifests, spiritually, not culturally, religiously, whatever it may be, whatever way you want to categorize community, blessed souls, no individual or community should allow itself to fall into complacency or laziness. There's always something to be done. There's always some part of the creation that needs to be uplifted and brought back to a level a little bit higher than the way it was when it was given to us, because that was the very purpose for which we were created. So there is a value which is intrinsic to work. Now, that doesn't mean that all types of work are the same. In fact, you know, it's a very good thing to be an upstanding and productive citizen. And this is included in God's directive to cultivate and guard the garden, the earth. But mere just mundane productivity will not enable us to fulfill the mission that was originally placed upon man and woman, Adam and Eve. So Dennis, your final comments on this, that we're not here just to do mundane stuff. At the same time, too, we should look for self-improvement within the context of hopefully making this place a more improved place as well. What's your take on these matters?
The take on the matter is that you're missing one word in all the words you just said in the last 2 minutes, Don, and that is the word maintenance. We humans are imperfect. Therefore, we must maintain things. If God gave us the Garden of Eden, we have to maintain things. You do that by being ever constant, ever active, and being aware of what your future duties are, your responsibilities. Similar to what Julia mentioned, that we're losing a lot of our values as time goes by, and they seem to be just wearing away for some reason or another. We were given the responsibility to maintain everything that God created. That includes our bodies as well as the planet, the universe. We must maintain. To maintain, you must be ever vigilant. Because if you sit down and sit on your tuchus for a while, things are going to go wrong. I'm sorry. That's how life works. It is a test. And it is a test of how attentive you can be to your responsibilities, to your creator, and to yourself, and to other people.
Thank you, Dennis. Julia, this idea of working the garden, we're all gardeners because this is God's garden. What can we do to encourage people to, even under these tough circumstances that we find ourselves now with, unfortunately, with the slippage of values and this drought and the economy is kind of, it's still in a rough place. We're not where we should be, or where we would like to be, or we would hope to be. Things would be better for all of us. What can we do to take hope that we still can manage to improve ourselves, improve the garden, and make this a better world?
Well, I think it's something that it's unity, being there for each other. Being a true friend, I think we've all forgotten what it is to be a true friend to another person. You know, the going gets rough, we disappear. We're either don't know what to say, we don't know what to do, or we're afraid to do something. Or some people don't have like to say, just don't care about somebody else. They only care about themselves. And I think we've forgotten that. We do need each other. It's important to grow, to grow in love, to grow in wisdom, in knowledge, in any of it. We have to have each other. It's as simple as that.
And as deep as that as well. Thank you, Julia. Ron, I'll let you have the final word before I make my summary statement. The Garden of Eden, we're still there. Some people want to deny it, but we're still there. How do we make this garden grow?
Not by growing in our own personal growth also, because you're also part of that garden. And as much as we must attend to affairs outside of us, we also should attend to those inside of us, because our growth is also consistent with maintaining that garden. And I just want to elaborate a little bit also what Julia says, that many times people are faced with a problem and other people just, you know, disappear. And people have to realize that sometimes just your presence helps. You don't have to know what to say. Not always, you know, the right thing to say or to do, but it's our presence and simplicity of saying, you know, I feel bad for you, or I feel sorry, or that you're going through this. It's such an amazing help. And we honestly have to just get back to simplicity. And we don't always have to know the right thing to do or say, but just be there for people, be there for each other. And we'll find that it's not only comforting to them, but we also feel accomplished by that. But being there for others also makes us feel that we are worthy of being part of that person's problems, but also their healing. And that also heals us, because everything we do for others has a direct reflection on our soul, and it enhances our growth as people. So this is my thoughts on that issue.
Thank you. I'd like to thank Julia Taylor calling from Texas. Been a while since we got a caller from Texas, Dennis Ryan, and Ron Williams, my fellow New Yorkers. That's one of the few times you'll hear me with a New York accent, you know. But this is Don Zugman thanking everyone for joining in, and also a big shout-out to Facebook friend Deborah Forbeck, who is constantly sending me great nutritional information. I'd like to share with you this information to help restore the personal garden within each one of ourselves in terms of a health benefit, 10 health benefits of bananas. I'd like to read it off to you. Yes, we have some bananas, banana-filled information to share with you, blessed souls. Number one, 10 health benefits of bananas. Helps who wants to quit smoking, can boost brain power, relieves menstrual cramp, reduce itchy mosquito bites, prevents anemia, promotes healthy bones, reduces depression, lowers risk of heart disease and hypertension, regulates bowel movements, helps people with ulcer. And that's coming off of www.drjohnchar.com/blog. And this is Don Zuzio Goodman reminding you, as your humble cyberspace Torah activist, that rebuilding, repairing, improving this garden of Eden, this garden of earth, with the earth is a garden, although it might seem drought-ridden in some places and flood-ridden in other places. It's a place where right now, this time, we can remove hatred from the world if we want to. We can remove jealousy if we want to. We can remove all forms of senseless competition, because one day, as Youthman Manasseh sings about in this following a cappella version, we shall see Bezer Hashem, Ahav Echad, one love, Goral Echad, one destiny, Kulano, for all of us, Badarchi Shalom, and a peace way, Darchi Noam. And I just want to mention, unfortunately, next week we won't have a show, because it's a very awesome fast day, and I'm hesitant to do a show. Hopefully we'll return in 2 weeks, unless the Mashiach, the Messiah, the Lion of Judah, shall roar out today, or sometime before Tisha B'Av, the Torah Chadashah, the new insights of Torah, which will gently guide the human family experience into that experience, which is reflective of the one Creator and His original plan to put us in a Garden of Eden, a place where we can love and have fear of Him and have faith in Him and fellowship with others in the best possible way. Take care, everyone.
Hello.
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 Under the moon, I thank God I'm breathing. Then I pray, don't take me soon, cause I am here for a reason. Sometimes in my tears I drown, but I never let it get me down. So when negativity surrounds, I know someday it'll all turn around, because all my life I've been waiting for, I've been praying for the people to say that we don't want to fight no more. There'll be no more wars, and our children will play. One day, one day, one day. Children will play.